Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your host, Paul David, founder and CEO of Literal Humans. And I'm joined today by Ivan Gecht, the CEO of GetSoft USA. And we're going to be talking about engineering durability in complex systems. Welcome to the pod, Ivan.
Thank you.
So by way of introduction, Ivan and the folks at GetSoft, they're a leader in software delivery for highly regulated environments, and we'll get into what those environments are. Ivan's journey is fascinating. He started as a Siberian aerospace engineer, the first we've had on the podcast, before transitioning into the high-stakes world of fintech and trading. He is a creator of the NYSE's NYSE's first ever FX monitor and has spent over 16 years leading GetSoft in developing market infrastructure for large financial organizations. And we love fintech. We've worked with a lot of fintechs, Wise and ChipperCash, and you know, we're big fans of fintech here. Ivan brings a unique systems-first philosophy to tech, focusing on durability and accountability over simple acceleration. And that's a little, you know, it's a big debate. You know, are we going to move fast or are we going to be safe and durable? So I'm looking forward to getting into this conversation with you. So first things first, Ivan, help us set the scene here for our audience. Why do complex systems need more of an aerospace mindset? And how does that discipline translate to the world of fintech and regulated trading?
Sure. So in aerospace, and that's the way we've been trained from the very beginning, is you assume that failure is inevitable and you design the system to survive it. That matters in the software world right now, because the most failures doesn't come from like broken features. They come from interactions between things that work fine on their own. And I've seen more than once the systems where each part, you know, passes every test and then still something fails in production because two, you know, safe changes combined in an unsafe way, right? So like this airspace mindset, you can call it, it actually forces you into thinking and designing the system as a whole, not just the individual parts that work together.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's really interesting. So would love to hear about, I mean, I love that idea that, you know, aerospace focuses on, you know, failure is inevitable. And I think that's like a very humanistic way to think, because it happens, right? So thinking about durability first, and, you know, do you believe the work is about, you know, is it about reinvention, or do you think it's about making sure critical systems kind of move forward safely? What is your sort of take on that?
So again, when we talk about fintech or regulated trading or similar industries, you can compare them to like working on an aircraft, right? So they live, they heavily regulated, and the failure have real consequences. And these consequences can be extremely heavy. One of the examples, it's from back in the day, but there was a company, or still maybe is, Knight Capital, who managed to lose like $400 million in a matter of just a few minutes of maybe an hour due to a bad release. Small changes might look harmless, but under severe market conditions, high volatility, everything can very, very quickly cascade into a much larger issue. And we can see that even in regular businesses, if you remember the situations where the companies would go bankrupt, even small ones, during the cloud adoption, when uncontrollable growth in the AWS or other clouds would lead to a humongous expenses, just because there was a small mistake somewhere made. When we talk about working in the fintech and regulated trading, innovation is necessary. Change is necessary. You can get away from it, but you have to do it in a way where it's reversible, where it's observable, where it's traceable, to make sure that you really have that business continuity that you need to have.
Really interesting. I think one thing that stands out, I mean, people obviously remember the 2008 financial crisis and you know, that a lot of, you know, controls on failure were not put in place or weren't in place initially. And a lot of folks feel like we're moving towards like kind of an AI bubble. So there's concern about that and whether the system can absorb that scale of failure. And so what's interesting to me is like failure in your world, it isn't theoretical. It is regulatory and it is operational. It's systemic, right? So how does that change, you know, your approach to delivery of, you know, sort of financial services, fintech goods, you know, all that?
You know, delivery changes, but to be honest with you, when we work in other industries, I wouldn't say that we significantly adjust the delivery practices just because it's less critical. Because when we talk about high stakes environment, and we talk about them a lot, they not always come from just regulations. They might be high stakes for you as a business owner, personal stakes. You have, you know, enough money to do something right once, and if you fail, the whole business fails. That's a definition of high stakes, right? So in this situation, bad deployment, it's not just a ticket. It's an incident that leads to significant consequences. And that forces a lot more proactivity in delivery. So you're thinking a few steps ahead. What are we delivering? Why are we delivering? How we ensure that, again, we can roll back? How we can ensure that the system can survive that change even if something goes wrong? And then you go from there.
And like to that point, you know, I'm curious about, you know, we've got this kind of move fast and break things mentality, and people are looking for growth at all costs. And you know, you mentioned uncontrollable growth. So how do you balance that need for, you know, rapid growth or even incremental change with this, you know, focus on operational stability and durability?
So we live in a very interesting world right now where amplification becomes a king, right? So everything is oriented toward amplification of something. We have a lot of money moving into the venture world, right? So a lot of businesses get amplified with external capital. Now we had cloud that can, again, amplify your whole systems, your whole stack very, very fast. And now we have AI that can amplify a lot of your processes and everything, again, very, very fast. When we encounter this situation, we have to really think about what are we amplifying. Because if you look at the venture capital world, how many investments fail? They make money on the top 10%. They lose money on the 90%, right? So same way with AI, right? You have these great stories of businesses taking it and succeeding extremely well. And then you don't really hear about the 90% of the rest who tried to amplify what was broken in the first place. So when you build systems for durability, you build it with the same approach, you know, foundation first, processes, governance, code quality, all of that. And once all of that, the certain level of standards is in place, then you can really amplify it, and then you can start scaling fast.
Moving a bit into the work that you do, you've been at the helm of GetSoft USA for nearly 15 years, and that alone is impressive. I've been running a company for five, almost 6 years, and so I know that takes a third of what you've done. And you've been dealing with long-lived platforms and major, you know, U.S. exchanges like the New York Stock Exchange. We'd love to understand, you know, if you could walk us through the challenge of making software changes that coexist with really strict regulatory obligations, but also ambitious growth targets. Like navigating that tension with the software seems like a fascinating challenge.
It is. And it really forces you to think again more deeply into what are you doing instead of just focusing on one singular part. So for example, regulations. Regulations don't stop the change. And we have witnessed over the past 20 years some regulations that not only didn't stop the change, it facilitated change in a pace that was unbearable for a lot of companies. So when you encounter situations like this, you often can see the team freeze a little bit, right? And what's going on? What shall we do? And when you start really digging into mapping the parts of the system that affected by the regulations, mapping out what is safe, mapping out what is more risky, right? You have a risk registry, you have all the strategies in place to deal with this. Suddenly, most changes became safe, right? The fear comes from not understanding the system, not from the regulation, for example, itself. So same way we approach when we build systems for a long-term use, right? We had an application that's been running in production for 15, 16 years at least, and it was evolving throughout all of this time. And it actually, once we stopped the support of the system, it survived for another 3 or 4 years without making changes. What goes into that is building out the system that can withstand, right? So our CTO always says that any system we build, the minimal timeline that it has to survive is 3 years from the moment that we deploy it, even if we don't make any changes. So it affects the architecture. It affects, again, the code quality. It affects the selection of the technologies, because when you see technologies that come and go and come and go and come and go, you really need to be wary about what are you selecting and what are you using. If something is hype, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to survive as long as you need it to.
Yeah. Interesting. Getting into like a bit more into kind of like the product and the, you know, the build side of things, like I want to talk about the kind of the ownership and the reality of live systems that, you know, need to run on a regular basis. You've said that intent doesn't matter, outcomes do, right? And I think that's a powerful statement. Would love to understand like what, you know, technical ownership really looks like once a system is live. How do you maintain it? How do you grow it and augment it? I'm really curious about that.
It looks excited. Let me phrase it this way. For example, I have a team that realistically owns a project, right? And they really feel accountable for it. So looking through the Slack channels, right, I can see things like, hey, guys, this is the new release. Can somebody go just try? We did this. How do people feel about it? Right. It's not even our product. It's something we do for our customer. But they still are asking for feedback. And then they go in and they research what were the recent attacks, what the currently the best practices on the security side of things. They're implementing this. So there is a huge SLA on that to make sure that we keep the system updated. And then new technologies or new tools get brought in because they can see that the efficiency can go up, both in implementing the changes and ensuring that the system stays reliable through that change. So it comes from little things that people do, and you expect maybe to a certain perspective people to do that, but then when it's all working together, you can see people looking beyond the scope of the system and coming back with the proposals for the customer. Hey, like, we can do this and this and this because we can see, even though it's not a part of our system, we can see it can benefit the system that you have as a whole. And then it's a much better collaboration.
I wanted to, like, getting into collaboration, like now if people they're collaborating with AI assistants and things like that, and you've talked about this, right? So want to talk about your work at fxcodebase.com, and you know, it's a community for algorithmic trading. Let's talk about the rise of automated trading and how it's changed the risk landscape for developers and kind of how have things shifted as a result of it?
I mean, algorithmic trading has been there for a very long time. I think we founded FX Codebase in 2009, if I'm not mistaken. It's been a while since we've been in that area, and algorithmic trading has the exact same benefits and pitfalls as, let's say, AI adoption right now. It amplifies the mistakes that you are making, and it amplifies the good decisions that you are making. In algorithmic trading, 95% is not about implementation of a particular strategy. It's designing and developing that strategy in a way that is safe for you to use and in a way that you can make money on. For example, once we start running the community, some of the features in the products that we were working on, like optimization, backtesting, market emulation, a lot of these things appeared because people needed these tools to make sure that they can trade successfully. But when it comes to building the community, it's all about the support and the content and making sure that people have a place to go to ask questions, to have these conversations, and to really get all the tools that they need to succeed.
Yeah, makes sense. Speaking of tools to succeed, you've gone on record saying that developers, you know, might be gaining not very much, you know, quite little from AI coding assistance. And we'd love to understand, like, where do you think the industry is kind of, you mentioned hyping, like overhyping technology at the expense of learning or quality?
So with AI assistance, we work a lot around this. And the way I look at things changes over time. And right now, what I see more, it's not even that it's not benefiting as much. It's more polarized, so to speak. So you either get great benefits from it or you get a lot of harm from it.
But isn't that just like, isn't that just, I always think about this, like, isn't that just humanity? Like, some people are going to use the tool you know, quite well and know its limits and their limits, and other people are going to overuse it or underuse it? Like, isn't that just kind of a natural distribution of people using tools?
You know, it is a natural distribution to a point.
Normal distribution, yeah.
I think that where it's getting a little bit hard right now is that we have way more pressure from media, from peers, from, you know, it being out there sounding from every corner. So it on one hand, the AI hype is going a little bit down because it's becoming a commodity, right? So now almost everyone used AI one way or another on their phones with the ChatGPT or with the AI assistant. So generating fun memes using, you know, AI adoption in the messaging. So people can kind of getting an understanding of what it's capable of and getting a better and realistic picture of what it's not capable of, right? Because when you start actually using it and you see that it's not perfect, you are not as afraid and scared that, oh my God, it's going to replace me. But on the other hand, for example, we ran a little pilot project. We needed to migrate an open source library from one technology to another. It used to be, projects like this used to be a 3-month, 4-month project for a team of 4 or 5 people. So we had that particular project done in just over a week with one senior level developer and AI assistant. Right? So the performance increase was incredible. 130,000 lines of code. So it feels impossible when you look at the numbers to do it that fast. Right. But at the same time, I've seen when the junior level developers take AI and without proper approach and understanding to how the architecture should look like and how the code should be organized and all of that, it's becoming a mess much faster than it used to be when they were doing the development manual.
Interesting. We'd love to dig into kind of your background a bit more and your kind of personal journey. You've gone from being a lead QA engineer in 2003 to a CEO today, and you've seen, you know, all different sides and angles of the software lifecycle. We'd love to understand like your sort of, you know, predictions for the future and like, you know, where do you see the future of business agility based on your experience, like heading in the near future and what in the next decade, like what can people expect from, you know, trading and market infrastructure? What might that look like?
I think, okay, so that's a very, very loaded question. So maybe let's take it apart a little bit. From a trading perspective, what we see right now is more of a unification of the experiences, right? So there are more and more and more tools coming to the market. There are more and more and more companies coming to the market. And it's getting more and more frustrating for people to try and manage everything that they have. You know, it's not only in trading, right? So people, I talk about the messaging right now. So you have your text messages, you have a WhatsApp and then Telegram and then Slack for work and then another application.
Suddenly it drives me crazy. Why do they all have messaging components? Like why does someone think that messaging me on Instagram is a serious way to communicate with me? Like, it's just like, we don't need messages for all these things.
I know, right? So it's same thing happens in fintech. So what we see the rise of in some of our latest case studies were built around super apps, so to speak, right? So a singular portals that offer a user experience and then a multitude of services within them. And that actually shows, we did a market study on that as well. It shows significant effect on user churn, on how much time users are willing to spend in the application itself, on how much money can companies make by having that. So everybody will try, or the majority will try, to unify the experiences. So it will be even more fight between, you know, titans and smaller companies trying to really find their place in the market and then maybe getting acquired and become a part of a bigger system altogether to get that unified user experience. Mm. When it comes to technology, it's a much different conversation, right? So What we see is that the technological market boomed crazily in the past 20 years, right? So we had such a humongous influx of developers, people switching careers and going into the software development as coders just because there was a lot of money there. So what's going to change with AI is that when you look at the AI coding, you can't replace your best people by using AI, but you can replace people who are only capable of coding because AI can do the coding, right? It cannot design a good system. It cannot maintain a good system. You need people for that still, but it can amplify and remove a lot of that tedious tasks that takes a lot of time and that a lot of companies use junior level developers to fill in, right? But then once you get rid of all the junior level developers in 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to have a conversation where we're going to get the senior level developers who never got through that journey, right? Because as you mentioned, right, I went through almost every role. I wasn't working so much on the development side of things, but from the QA, business understanding, business analysis, product management, project management, I did all of that. And that brought the experience and the understanding that helps me lead the business right now. So if that's taken away and replaced with AI, what are we going to do?
Yeah, it's a big question that a lot of people are, you know, worried about trying to answer. And it's a juicy one. It's an unfair question to ask you, but we did our best to work through it. I'd love to dig more into I love this publication that you are, working on, the Agile Bulletin.
Yeah.
You co-founded it and it shares unpopular opinions, which I think is awesome. Like, people don't do that enough. Everyone's trying to curry favor. And what do you think are the most interesting things you've learned from that and things about how teams adjust and innovate and lead in this kind of ever-changing world, which you just mentioned? So what have been some of your favorite unpopular opinions and the reactions to those?
Okay, so a little bit of a backstory behind Agile Bulletin, right? We created it because we saw that 3-4 years ago, we saw that the whole unhappiness of a general business around Agile is starting to boil up. And when you go and you go to the conferences and you read through the LinkedIn posts or, everything that's popular where people are doing that, everything was intended more and more towards the general beliefs that public liked, that Agile crowd liked. And this is an awful situation, right? And this is one of the pitfalls of the AI, generative AI and large language models, is that they trained to be liked, not to be correct. And the same things happens to us as people. So experts in the industry or bigger names started talking more and more about what's being liked, what's being popular, instead of talking what's necessary. And that led to the situation where right now, if you go into the majority of organizations who tried Agile and ask, okay, so what do you think about Agile? They're going to tell you a lot of things and not a lot of them are going to be good. Because Agile got turned away from the core basics of outcomes over outputs.
Yeah.
That outcomes matter, outputs don't. And it turned in from that toolkit that you can use to get the results into a lifestyle, or it added the feeling of moral superiority to it, of people thinking like, we are doing Agile, so we are better than those who are doing traditional waterfall, whatever it means right now.
It's the danger of too powerful branding. Like, it became a thing unto itself, and it's like anyone can pick it up and turn it into what they want. Yeah.
It's a shame. And it turned out to be not the thing that it was created. And right now we can see a lot of changes happening around that with the active PMI work, with the Agile community to bring it back, because we need Agile. We need business agility. We live in the world where you cannot survive on just predictability, because things change too often because of the scale and the speed that we are able to achieve with all the infrastructure changes and AI and everything. You need that ability to change, but you need to be prepared for it, and you need to have the right instruments. You need to have the right frameworks, and Agile is one of them. Yeah. Agile is a great tool to deal with the complexity.
It's a tool in the toolbox, not everything.
It's done right.
When
it's done as intended, as a scientific approach to the software development, or even to business.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, to that point, like one thing I think about a lot, you know, we have a load of remote team members. I know you've managed remote teams long before it was the norm, and, you know, some have been agile, some in other contexts. So I would love to hear from you, like, what's one thing that people, you know, get wrong about remote leadership that you've learned, hey, this is a core principle that you've practiced in terms of how you've led remote teams?
Remote work doesn't fail because of distance. It fails because ambiguity scales faster than trust. Right. So I think this was the hardest lesson for me personally as a leader, and a place where I failed more times than I'm willing to admit, is that you need to be way more communicative and explicit in what you are saying and what you're tolerating over just working in the office. Because you lose a lot of the osmosis learning. You lose a lot of the... Even communication-wise, again, people remember 22% or something like that of what we say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and then they get 70% of whatever in the information through nonverbal communication, right? So now imagine you are typing in chat.
Yeah.
So you lost 70% there, and then they remembered only 22% of what you said. And suddenly communication is the biggest issue. So really... I've seen teams stall because simply two people thought that another one owned the decision, and then no decision was made.
Yeah.
Right. So when you change the way you communicate, and it's not just about I need to be a better communicator. It's very, very often I need to have higher standards. I need to have certain expectation. I need to hold people more accountable than I would do in an in-person environment to make sure that they succeed and that we succeed.
Yeah. It pushes you. You can't be as implicit and as, you know, as making as many assumptions about, because as you said, the osmosis learning doesn't happen. I remember it shocked me, like leading remote teams, where I had to like actually tell people like, hey, like, I know this is remote work, but like, should you be on your couch, you know, like in a robe, you know, like for a client meeting, or like, does it make sense to have, you know, sort of, you know, like a bunch of people running around in the background when you're talking to a client, like things that you wouldn't ever think you had to tell adult humans, like, yeah, like, hey. And it's so, yeah, once you get over that, you just say that, and it's, you know, people have lives and they have families and stuff. Yeah, fine. But it's, yeah, it's interesting to kind of see, you know, what common sense passes for in a remote context versus what you have to really say out loud. And I love your point here, like that quote, like remote doesn't fail because of distance and because ambiguity scales faster than trust. That's amazing. We're gonna use that. So really, really well said. I want to move us into the quick fire questions. So this is just like quick answer. First thing that comes to your mind, it's a way for the audience to kind of get to know you in a fun way. I'm going to hold you to it. So again, just like a quick answer and then then a sentence explanation maybe. Quick fire. First question, if you could found another startup or another company, what would it be and why?
It would be something in the world of transparency when it comes to risk and reality, basically, right? So as a leader, I'm often miss the tools that help me see the situation for what it is or for what it is perceived to be, right? So having these tools that make invisible visible is great.
And also as a leader too, I feel like you don't always get the full story. Like people tell you a version, you know, to like protect their position, or, you know, like, so, and so I find that challenging. It's like, how do you get the real information? But yeah, really well said. Two questions about inventions. What invention makes you the most excited, and which tech invention makes you the most scared or concerned right now?
Which invention makes me the most excited? You know, I think it's the same one, right? I love the world of AI. I love how it changes the way we work. I love how it brings the a lot of clarity and information and ability to find and process that information really, really fast. At the same time, it's the invention that scares me the most, because again, the way that system is built right now and what we already see is that it built to please, not to really bring the value of an honest and truthful opinion. So you have to rely more on people. Otherwise, we're going to be in the world of yes men, right? Yeah. Everybody's just saying something that everyone wants to hear, and then nothing gets done.
Definitely. So back to the human. So who is a literal human that you want to shout out who's been integral to your career journey?
No, whenever I'm asked this question, it's I'm always remember I'm not a very religious person by any means, but there is like you shall not make for yourself an idol, right? And that's something to live by. It would be unfair to name a singular person.
It could be. It doesn't have to be an idol. But, it could just be a mentor or a coach or a friend, a parent. Yeah, anyone.
Yeah I can no certainly pressure. Say that there was a lot of people who really defined my journey.
That's great.
And I always try to learn something from everyone I meet and apply it and use it. So I'm a part of Vistage community and my group is amazing. Yes, and yes. My father, my brother, who I used to work with and with my brother, we still do for 20 years. Like I can't even name the number of times that he helped me change and become better and pushed and the competition. That's and great. The customers we work with, I met with their leadership, and if every one of them bringing such a different perspective on how to lead and the vision.
You're doing the award show where you name everybody.
Yeah. I know, right?
You can't do it the other way. Like, that's sort of the point where, like, how do you just pick one? No, but I appreciate it. There's lots of people, and you're blessed if you have like an array of people over your life who have helped
okay.
you. So that's
I can name one person who really changed me. That's gonna be easy. It's my son.
That's a great answer.
But ever since he appeared in my life, and he's almost 17 now, I think the amount of change he brought to me as a person, as a father, as a leader.
That's amazing. That's
it's
a great
more
answer.
Than I can speak about.
See, we just need you to focus in. Then you gave one of the best answers we've ever had. I don't think we've had that many people say they're kids, and that's awesome. And I think too, like I think about this a lot as a former educator, is like that two-way learning. Obviously, people are like, yeah, I taught my kids a lot of stuff, but like they teach you a ton of stuff. So to say that is, it says a lot about your character. So thank you for that, Ivan. And then, last question. What's an inspirational quote that has stuck with you through your journey in tech?
Can I give two?
Sure. Make it quick. Lightning round.
Yes. So one is the unprepared mind cannot see the outstretched hand of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a quote from the inventor of penicillin. And he was talking about that, you know, a lot of scientists saw the same things that he did see before him, but nobody could imagine that the mold can be used like something as disgusting as mold can be used like a medicine. So you really have to have an open mind to actually invent. That's one. And the second one is a complex system that works is invariably found to have evolved from a simple system that worked. Right? I think it's John Gall is the author of that quote. And it just shows that the step-by-step evolution is how we really make the change safe. And we build something simple that works. And then we start making safe, predictable, and explainable changes to evolve that. And it doesn't necessarily have to kill an ambition.
Right.
You know, but again, ambition without that support of the foundation, that's what kills the business.
No, that's fantastic. No, thank you for that. Those are two great quotes. Well, I really appreciate your time today, Ivan. I think, your perspective reminds us that behind every trade and transaction and fintech and the financial space, there's a complex system that requires, rigorous engineering and accountability and durability. And it's really interesting to speak to one of the folks who's behind one of the creation and maintenance of those systems. I think you're showing that in tech, true innovation is often built on a foundation of dependability. And I think sometimes we get loss and the glitz and the glam and the speed. And really, we rely on these systems every single day, your banking app, your credit card, all that stuff. So really appreciate you joining us. Ivan, where can listeners learn more about your work at GetSoft and follow your insights on Agile?
Absolutely. Well, first, Paul, thanks for having me over. Some great questions. Not easy to answer a lot of them. And the listeners can find me on LinkedIn, I think is the easiest way. I'm Ivan, Ivan Gecht, Gekht. And then we publish a lot, our team posts a lot on our company page at GetSoft on LinkedIn as well. Agile Bulletin has its own LinkedIn page too, where we publish more of Agile insights.
Thanks.
So
We'll include those links in the episode description. And yeah, I think I'll subscribe to Agile Bulletins. I'm looking to maybe get involved with Agile for our growth team. But yeah, thank you again. This has been another great episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. I've been joined today by Ivan Gecht, the CEO of GetSoft USA. We've been talking about engineering, durability, and complex financial systems. Thanks again, Ivan. And to our listeners, please give us a review and a 5-star rating. It helps us get more great guests like Ivan onto the show. Thanks, Ivan.
Thank you.